From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The White House summit this week on violent extremism will take on a whole range of tough issues. In Europe, events of the last few weeks have really focused the mind. Paris, Copenhagen, and now a slaughter on the shore of North Africa and an ISIS threat to take Rome. This hour on Point, Europe and ISIS. Joining me first today from North Africa, Rabat in Morocco, is Isander El Amrani. He's project director for North Africa for the International Crisis Group and has been watching what's going on in Libya closely. Isander, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
Tell us what you know about those men. We see in the video, and I have not watched it all the way through, but like others, I've seen them preparing to behead these 21 poor Coptic Christians on their knees, behind them, in their typical kind of ISIS outfits, these guys holding each at the back of the collar, knife in hand, and the deed was done, a terrible deed. Then the dagger pointed toward the north in Europe and this threat to go on to Rome. Who are these guys, Isander?
Well, they're people who are taking advantage of the chaos that prevails in Libya and has prevailed since last summer when the government basically split in two. You now have two parliaments, two governments in Libya, and absolutely no state. Vast areas that are completely ungoverned, that ISIS has found a way to take advantage of that chaos and that vacuum to establish itself, establish its bases. And one thing that's clear is that this is not just a purely Libyan phenomenon. ISIS mothership, if you will, in Iraq and Syria has designated Libya as their next point of expansion. They see the opportunity that you're in a quasi-state of civil war in Libya today, and just as they took advantage of a similar situation in Iraq and in Syria, they're now poised to take advantage of that in Libya.
You know this region so much better than I. When you watch that video, and I'll play a little bit of the sound of it in just a moment here.
I would advise people not to watch that video.
No, I don't mean the whole thing, by no means. But you must have seen enough to see the guys. Are you thinking these are men who have come from the caliphate, the self-styled caliphate in Syria and Iraq? Are you thinking these are local recruits with somebody from ISIS Central, the mothership, as you put it, come in to like direct the theater of this? What do you imagine we were seeing on that beach?
Well, what we're probably seeing is a mixture of local groups that are composed of Libyans, Libyan radicals, and there's a history of them existing since the 1990s when there was an insurgency against the Gaddafi government, especially in the town of Derna, which today is kind of ISIS central in Libya, and that's in the east of the country. Mm-hmm. But as well, there's been consistent reports backed by public statements of ISIS, Iraq, Syria, and from the caliphate, encouraging people to more experienced commanders from ISIS in Iraq to go to Libya to train people there, and also using Libya as a training base, again, because of this complete vacuum of security and the absence of a state, to use as a recruiting center, a training base for people to then go on and fight in Syria and Iraq. So it's a mixture, basically. But it includes a mixture of locals and people coming from neighboring countries.
There's the terrible brutality, murder of all these poor Egyptian guys on the beach, and then there's the threat to the north. Here's a little of the sound of this video. This is released Sunday, showing the beheading of 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians. And here, a masked ISIS member, self-identified, saying, no one is safe. They're on their way.
And today, we're on the south of Rome, on the land of Islam, Libya, sending another message. O Crusaders, safety for you will be only wishes, especially when you're fighting us all together.
No safety for you, Crusaders. All this kind of medieval language, and then this threat.
And we will conquer Rome by Allah's permission, the promise of our Prophet, peace be upon him.
There, the ISIS murderers on the beach in Libya. Isander El Amrani is with the International Crisis Group with us today from Rabat, Morocco. What do you make of that statement, that threat being put at the heart of this video? Is that about building prestige within Libya, within the Middle East region? Is it a real threat? Is this just grandstanding? What do you hear when you hear that, Asami?
Well, I mean, what you have to keep in mind is that ISIS operates very much at the level of strategic communications. When it killed, you know, this is a tragedy, obviously, for the 21 Egyptian Copts who were murdered. But this isn't a significant military advance. So they're using this as a tactic of shock and awe, if you will. They're saying, look, we'll go beyond the pale of anyone else will do.
Shock and awe, yeah.
You know, and we're ready to do the most gruesome thing to prove that we have the willpower to go all the way. And this is what we've seen from ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So it's what we've seen from other groups. So they're in a logic of confrontation with the West, of confrontation with the Arab regimes in the region, and this is the kind of messaging, you know, that basically boosts their own credentials among that element of whether it's the Libyan public, the Arab public, that feels that could be amenable to influence, or that sees in ISIS something that is fighting the anti-imperialist fight, that is correcting the injustices of the Arab world and so on.
Do you see the possibility of ISIS consolidating some kind of grip within this chaotic Libyan scene, controlling troops, controlling turf?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, we're seeing signs of this happen. When ISIS first started showing up in Libya, basically on the back of pre-existing radical groups that were not as radical as ISIS, they were mostly centered around the town of Derna in the east, which had a history of radicalism. And what we're seeing now is that they've spread in Sirte, in the center of the country, and in Sabratha, in the west of the country. So we're seeing them gain control of certain elements of territory. And this is where ISIS and an organization like Al-Qaeda have quite different strategies. ISIS is interested in governing. It's interested in controlling and administering territory. And this is why it's done in Syria. This is why it's done in Iraq. So it has a clear MO, if you want, and the scary thing about Libya now is that as long as the fighting goes on between the two broad camps in Libya, which do not include radicals, they have the opportunity to do that.
And where does this go? Are there other countries in North Africa that could be vulnerable to this sort of infiltration and upheaval? Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, where you are, Egypt?
Well, ISIS has already declared an affiliate in Egypt, in the Sinai Peninsula, and Northeast Sinai in particular has been fighting an insurgency against the Egyptian military that despite the Egyptian military, you know, conducting massive military operations to try and contain it, lingers on. It looks a little bit like Iraq in 2004 with the IEDs, improvised explosive devices, attacks, recurrent attacks against Egyptian military and police targets, and so on. What was interesting was when last summer, in 2013, ISIS made this big advance in Iraq and the caliphate was created, and it called on others across the region, including in North Africa, to follow. Not many at a time took up that call. Most of the groups the mostly Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups that exist in the region, especially in northern Mali, parts of Libya, the remnants of groups that had existed that fought the Algerian civil war in the 1990s, refused to join ISIS. Now, the question is that as ISIS uses these kind of spectacular attacks to gain, you know, to essentially beef up its street cred, you know, is that going to change? We're not seeing signs of it officially in the region widely, but we have seen signs of it in Libya.
Sandra, you're right there, sort of on the front row seat. Where is the possibility of stability here that's anti-ISIS or not ISIS? Where's the floor of stability that doesn't involve a caliphate coming to North Africa?
Well, I mean, as far as Libya is concerned, as a very, very first step, I think there needs to be a lot more efforts to ensure that the talks that the UN is trying to broker between the rival Libyan governments succeed, because it'll be very hard to fight ISIS in Libya and to prevent ISIS from using Libya as a base to expand in the region if Libya continues in its current state of chaos. The best hope for fighting Libya is if these talks succeed, if there's a unified government in Libya once again, and that unified government, you know, both sides are interested in fighting ISIS, so they, that's the one thing that they agree on, are actually able to cooperate together and also with the international community to take on this challenge, because they don't want to see ISIS in their country any more than we do.
We're talking about Europe across the Mediterranean looking at this. What about where you are in Morocco? What do you hear in the streets there? Are people saying, you know, oh my God, here comes ISIS? Here they come? Or these are just dramatic gangsters and not a big deal?
Well, obviously, throughout the Arab world, people are very worried about this phenomenon. And Morocco has been more fortunate than most in that it hasn't seen large-scale terrorism in over 10 years. The country has been on maximum alert since last summer. Even though it's far away from Libya, it's very concerned about the repercussions. And there is another thing that's common with all of these countries in North Africa. Many of them, including Morocco, Tunisia, Egypt, contribute large numbers of recruits to ISIS. They don't stay in the country itself. They go and fight in Libya, fight in Iraq, fight...
They go to where ISIS is. Isander El Amrani with the International Crisis Group there from Rabat, Morocco. Thank you very much for being with us, Isander. We're looking at Europe and ISIS. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Europe and ISIS from North Africa to Copenhagen. Looking at the threat, we'll come to Rome and the pushback. Here's sound of a singer and music at a memorial service held in Monday in Copenhagen to commemorate victims of Sunday's terror attacks there. Here, Pope Francis on Monday condemning the Islamic State's beheading of 21 Egyptian Christians in Libya. He spoke in Spanish with an interpreter by his side.
Solamente decían, Jesús, ayúdame.
They only said, Jesus, help me.
So, fueron asesinados por el solo hecho de ser cristianos.
They were murdered just for being Christians.
And it feels like we're right back in a kind of medieval conversation here. We've got a great panel to look on into what Europe is facing here, and North Africa for that matter. With us today from London, Jutta Clausen. She's professor of international cooperation at Brandeis University, studies terrorism, Islam in the West, in Europe. Danish herself, Jutta Clausen, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me on the program.
From Oslo, Norway, Thomas Heghammer is with us, Director of Terrorism Research at the Norwegian Defense Research Establishment, author of Jihad in Saudi Arabia. Thomas Heghammer, thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for having me.
And in Washington, D.C., Bruce Hoffman, Director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University. Been studying terrorism and insurgency for a long, long time. Bruce Hoffman, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Jutta Clausen, let me come first to you. When you hear these ISIS guys standing on the beach in Libya and saying, we're going to conquer Rome, what do you hear?
I'm not concerned that the Islamic State will invade Europe. I'm far more concerned about the militants who already are in Europe. The strategy has been for some time on the part of the Islamic State to try to draw the West in to the conflict and to spread the conflict. They really just want to provoke. And this type of extreme violence has worked well for them, also as a recruitment tool. We have, the numbers vary, but we have about 3,000 people from Western Europe who are known to have gone to the conflict in Syria and Iraq, and some have already returned and been participants in terrorist attacks in Europe. And this is a far larger number of armed and ready militants loose on the streets of Europe than we have had at any previous time. So that's where the real concern is, in my view.
When you say that this is an effort by ISIS to draw the West in, I want to unpack that a little bit, see what you mean. I mean, you have Italy, they're talking about Rome. Rome is responding. They're bringing about 5,000 troops onto the streets this summer. You've got the interior minister in Italy, Angelino Alfano, saying ISIS is at the door, saying that they need UN peacekeeping mission in Libya for the future of the Western world. You've got the Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi saying Europe has to stop sleeping. Is this the drawing in? Is this playing into an ISIS strategy, or is this appropriate alarm?
It is playing into the ISIS strategy, and I'm not sure that it's appropriate alarm. Gruesome as those executions were, the facts on the ground are no different after the executions than they were before. And I don't think it's a good idea to respond in that type a panic mode to these provocations. The provocations also have, excuse me, a domestic effect, and that's psychological warfare. And ISIS used the same tactic to great effect in Syria and Iraq about a year ago when they started crucifixions and using social media to spread those pictures around. People really did get phenomenally scared.
Thomas Heghammer, in Oslo, Norway, you're watching the whole continent right down to North Africa right now, I'm very sure. How do you interpret this ISIS move? Do you see theater? Do you see provocation? What's the appropriate response?
Well, this is a question that analysts have been grappling with for a long time. And there are basically two schools of thought. One that says the IS is indeed set on sort of waging a terrorism campaign strategically in Europe. The other one says that the organization as such is not heavily invested in such a strategy. It is only sort of encouraging sympathizers to do that dirty work for them. I think it's useful to look at the kind of the evidence of actual plotting on the part of the organization. And what we see is a lot of plots and attacks in Europe and North America and Australia by IS sympathizers and sort of ex-foreign fighters with some kind of connection to IS. What we're not seeing is the kind of 9/11 type attack that is sort of strategically guided by the top leadership of the organization. That would be much more serious because it would cause more damage, and IS has, I think, the resources to carry out that sort of thing. But so far, we're not seeing these sort of large, centrally directed plots in the West, fortunately. But the question is, of course, will they come in the future?
Bruce Hoffman, it's kind of mind-boggling. Here we are talking about an organization that just last summer came onto most people's screens for the first time. And the next thing you know, here's this dramatic video right off the beach across the Mediterranean and these, you know, over-the-top kind of threats to conquer Rome. How do you look at this and Europe's place in this? Is this a sideshow to what ISIS is essentially up to? You know, Al-Qaeda came sort of right out of the box years in the making, but still to 9/11 and the big attack. Does ISIS see Europe as a real target, or this is just to keep the West off balance? How do you interpret this, Bruce?
Well, it's both of those things, really. It's designed to keep the West off balance, of course, but it also, I think, plays into ISIS's overall strategy, which is to be, you know, frankly, as horrific and as brutal as possible as a means to demonstrating its bona fides as being at the tip of the spear of the jihadi struggle, and in terms of really outdoing any recruits and new sources of funding. And people support, or at least unfortunately the people who support terrorism, support groups that they see as being effective. And a combination of ISIS's brutality and its, I think, very effective command of the media is delivering both thousands of recruits to them and, I think, revenue that they also generate themselves, but also that flows into their coffers from elsewhere.
Jutta Clausen, I've just got you for another couple of minutes. Describe to us what you see as the most effective countermeasures currently in Europe and what Europe's going to have to do, sitting where it does.
Well, Europe needs to start policing the militant hubs within its own territory. There have been, in the last 5 years, the emergence of jihadist counterculture in many places. And one of the amazing aspects of this emergence of a new cycle of militancy is that it's often located in smaller and mid-sized cities. We would expect Paris and London to be on that list, not places like Göteborg, my hometown in Denmark, Aarhus, or smaller cities like Antwerpen and beyond. That is where the recruits for ISIS come from, the ones who go to fight. They come from these hubs, really local networks and local groups that are operating quite openly in Europe. And they have the sympathizers who do not make it out. There's no indication, for instance, that the perpetrator of Saturday's attacks in Copenhagen had any previous fighting experience outside the country. He came from a gang background and had apparently been radicalized in prison. This is where the real domestic security threat comes from. Then, of course, Europe needs to participate in a broader strategy about what to do with the Middle East. But the more immediate thing that Europe needs to do is to do something about the groups at home.
Jutta Clausen, Brandeis University, Danish, joining us today from London. Jutta, I know we have to let you go. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on the program.
Bruce Hoffman, Thomas Heckhammer, stand by in Oslo, Norway, and Washington. We have lots of callers for you. 800-423-8255. Michelle in Cleveland, Ohio. Thank you for calling, Michelle. You're on the air.
Yes. My question is, actually I have two. What is it within the religion of Islam that gives rise to all of these radical movements in such diverse cultures from Africa to the Middle East that leads to these terrorism groups? And I know in Christianity they had various councils to sort of revamp teachings to and is there anything like that within Islam where the clerics are looking at what is this interpretation of the Quran that's leading to this? And my second question is, I don't hear anyone talking about the fact that the egregious mismanagement of the invasion of Iraq is what has led to all of this, disenfranchising all of the generals of Saddam Hussein who are obviously spearheading this movement. That's my question. Thank you.
Michelle, thanks for both. We'll pick them up. Thomas Heckhammer, can I come first to you? Europeans must be thinking a lot about this, but you hear Michelle's question about Islam and how across different cultures and now into and including European cultures, you have a subset of Muslims who are responding to this call. How do you think about the religion and what may be at work here, Thomas?
Well, this is a question that's being widely debated now in Europe. What is the role of Islam in all of this? And it's a question that's extremely difficult to answer because it's sort of a grand and vague one. What I will say, though, is that we should be careful to ascribe to Islam a sort of causal effect, that it sort of always produces violence, because there is huge variation, both geographically and chronologically. So it's only in certain places or in certain countries that you have a serious problem of Islamist violence, and it has only been in certain limited periods of time that we've seen this. If Islam was inherently violent, we would see constant violence everywhere, and we don't. Also, what we see is that a lot of, when we study recruitment and radicalization, what we see is that a lot of people join for reasons other than ideology. They're pulled in through social networks. They're attracted by the sort of the companionship or the sense of adventure and so on. And only later on in the radicalization process do they learn about the ideology. and then they reach back into the sources, the scripture, and so on, to justify their actions. And the reason why kind of the religious aspect is so prominent here is that it's kind of in the nature of this ideology to anchor everything it does in sort of religious tradition. And it so happens that the tradition is very, very rich. You can, if you want, justify almost anything by referring to something that happened earlier in Islamic history. And even then, if you don't find exactly, you know, a precedent for it, you know, the radical ideologues will say that they can do it anyway because they have a certain license to do so.
Thomas, I want to take that same question to Bruce Hoffman, but what about Michelle, the second part of her inquiry there about the Iraq War and its sparking role in getting this all rolling? Do you agree with her interpretation?
Well, the invasion of Iraq was a necessary cause of the rise of Islamic State because without the insurgency that came after the invasion, the Islamic State or its previous incarnations would not have existed. But it's too simple to attribute kind of all the blame to that invasion because it's a long time ago and a lot of things have happened since then. And successive Iraqi governments bear also a considerable responsibility for their sectarian politics, which have not sort of done much to deal with the grievances in the Sunni Arab population in Iraq. So, yes, the Iraq War was an important sort of prerequisite for all this, but it doesn't explain the whole story.
Bruce Hoffman, come to the Islam piece of this. There's a piece by Graham Wood in the Atlantic magazine, the March issue, which is lots of people are talking about these days. And the, you know, he writes there, it's written that the Islamic State is no mere collection of psychopaths. It is a religious group with carefully considered beliefs. Among them, that it is a key agent of the coming apocalypse. Graham Wood writes, the reality is that the Islamic State is Islamic, very Islamic, but it goes all the way back to a kind of very medieval interpretation or sort of straight out of its birth period of Islam. So what's the significance of that? As Europe grapples with this, as Washington in its summit grapples with this, the way that religious tradition has been harnessed by ISIS, Bruce?
Well, I think fundamentally what we see is that religion is the glue that holds together this movement. It's something that appeals to its followers on a very personal, a very visceral level. It's something that makes it easier for those recruits and fighters in ISIS to identify with. So I think on that level, it has a very strong appeal. And of course, it's apocalyptic dimensions that this is a an absolutely existential struggle also is very important in motivating, rallying, animating fighters to its cause. But I would say what ISIS's success has been, and Iskander earlier pointed to this, is that unlike Al-Qaeda, ISIS governs. I mean, this is part of its DNA, and it's been very effective at supplanting local corrupt governance with what they see as a much more effective means of governance. Of course, it's completely dominated by the most brutal and repressive regime possible. But fused into that, and this is something that Thomas said that I think is enormously important, is that religion, as I said, may be the glue, but I think it's this sense of catharsis that ISIS has tapped into. In other words, this hatred of the West, this desire to strike a satisfying blow against a condition or a situation that they feel has given rise to these grievances. And basically, ISIS is giving young men and women, unfortunately, the tools with which to do so, and that is part of their appeal.
I want to come back and look at those grievances and, in particular, how Europe is thinking about addressing them, if that's what it's going to take, or about addressing the threat more directly. Bruce Hoffman at Georgetown University, please stand by there. Thomas Hegghammer in Oslo at the Norwegian Defense Research Establishment. We're talking about Europe and ISIS from North Africa to Copenhagen. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Audible has more than 150,000 titles to choose from, plus exclusive content. From fiction, nonfiction, bestsellers, every category imaginable, so you're certain to find something interesting. On Point listeners can try it for free. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint. And get started today.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Europe and ISIS, from North Africa to Copenhagen, looking at the threat and the pushback there with Bruce Hoffman, director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University, author of The Evolving Global Terrorist Threat, and forthcoming out next week, Anonymous Soldiers, The Struggle for Israel, 1917 to 1947, with us from Washington. And from Oslo, Norway, watching the entire continent and well beyond, Thomas Hegghammer is with us, director of terrorism research at the Norwegian Defense Research Establishment, with us today from Oslo. Here's the sound of the Danish Prime Minister, this is Helle Thorning-Schmidt, telling reporters on Monday that this is not a faith-based struggle, but it is about values.
This is not a conflict between Muslims and non-Muslims. This is a conflict between the core values of our society and violent extremists. Collectively and united, we will remain who we are.
But no one's happy to see this kind of thing coming into their midst. At the Monday night vigil for victims, the two of the weekend's terrorist attacks in Copenhagen, this man condemned the attacks. It's sad, he said.
We are very sad it's come to Denmark, but we have to live with it, and we want to have an open society.
Bruce Hoffman, Thomas Hegghammer, questions from our listeners online. And here's one, Thomas, let me put to you. Bill says, why are we not talking about the production values of this video? It was a pretty sophisticated piece of video. Bill writes to us, as a person who works in TV and film, I understand the amount of training, personnel, and time it takes to produce a scene like this. All choreographed there on the beach, choreographed murder. He says, I can see the equipment being used, know how many trained individuals it takes to set up and maneuver. What about the infrastructure of people and expertise being maneuvered around North Africa, Thomas, to make this happen?
Yes, he's absolutely right. The quality of some of these videos is absolutely striking. They have, you know, many of them have the professional quality, and it illustrates the fact that IS and some other jihadi groups consist of basically technocrats. These are relatively highly educated people. They're not barbarians running around in the desert. And Islamic State and its predecessors in Iraq have always been at the forefront of using technology for its cause. It has to do with the fact that Iraq was a relatively highly sort of educated society when the insurgency began, and the fact that the insurgency drew people from what had been the kind of the elite.
The ruling Sunni elite of Iraq.
That's right. And many of the cadres of IS are former military officers that worked under Saddam Hussein. And in addition, they're being helped by sort of an anonymous small army of online jihadists, people who develop and circulate propaganda from different parts of the world, but keeping in touch with IS through the internet. So we have to realize that this is a very competent organization, and it's also an organization that's highly politically aware. They're not sort of isolated underground. They're reading widely. They're following the news, and they're in touch with sort of political opinion in the areas they operate in. So it means that we have to assume, for example, that they are thinking strategically, and that they are. We have to assume that they're not making always irrational decisions.
Bruce Hoffman, if that's true, how would you interpret the psychological step of the real-world murder of these 21 Egyptian Christians on the beach in Libya? What's the desired, what would they like to see provoked by that?
Well, two things, and you've hit the nail on the head by using the word provoke. All terrorism is designed to provoke some response. They hope that ISIS hopes that the response will suit their agenda, will enable them to better demonstrate that they are Islam's true defenders, that they are the only ones effectively fighting for the Ummah, for the Islamic community. Also, too, I think they're appealing to a very specific demographic. They're not appealing to the people that are horrified or that are shocked by their violence. They're appealing to people that have grown up on video games, that themselves are juiced up on wanting to participate in this struggle, to contribute to it, to strike this blow, and who they hope to recruit. And it's remarkable. I mean, in essence, just as Thomas said, I mean, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is their predecessor, was very effective at using the internet and the media. We see ISIS going yet another step beyond that and, in essence, eating our lunch in harnessing social media and also videos to serve their propagandistic purposes. And we've really been very ineffective, I think, in countering that.
So part of it is recruitment. At the White House summit today that's going on in Washington, first of 3 days there, we had the U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson saying, you know, they have the ability to reach into our communities and attempt to recruit and inspire individuals who may turn toward violence right here in the homeland. He's talking about the U.S., Europe facing that right in front of its face. Let's go to Ishwar, calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Ishwar, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Tom, in your discussions, when you mentioned that the ISIS people have used the word crusaders, you referred more than once as medieval language, and rightly so. And you also mentioned that the beheading of Coptic Christians a shock and awe situation.
Mm-hmm.
What I would like to bring with a proper perspective is these are warriors or soldiers or terrorists or whatever you want to call them. Where were you and your media when our own ex-President George W. Bush used the word crusaders during Iraq War?
Well, Ishwar, to that specific and clear question, I can answer you. We were right here talking very vividly about it. We were nowhere absent on that front whatsoever. But I take your point that the shock and awe wasn't made up outside this country, and the word crusade did come up in the early days after 9/11. Ishwar, I appreciate your call there. I mean, Bruce Hoffman, what about source of grievance and source of model here? If there are grievances that need to be addressed, ultimately, over time, for this to settle down, how would you define them?
Well, I think the main problem is only partly grievances. Grievances is what is animating the struggle. I think it's the vacuum of authority and governance that has firstly existed in North Africa and the Middle East for some time, but has certainly been exacerbated by the failure of the Arab Spring, is what's breathing life into this struggle.
But isn't that all tied up with governance? Because for decades, much of the authority, as you describe it, was tyrannical in this region, and didn't that breed a lot of the grievance, if that's what it is, it's emerging now.
Absolutely. In fact, Libya was the first country in the world to actually issue an international arrest warrant for Osama bin Laden precisely for this reason in the mid-1990s. So yes, absolutely. It was the tyrannical regimes that certainly gave rise to this form of resistance and this form of aggrievement.
The U.S. backed a fair number of those.
Right, but the U.S. also invaded Iraq in hopes of trying to reverse the tide, and many credit the Arab Spring with the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. I think the point is having the international commitment that having really smashed up a region very much and broken it into bits to help it to regain a modicum of stability to counter this chaos, that is really what's going to be the most effective long-term goal. This is beyond a social problem or a law enforcement problem. I mean, at the end of the day, providing stability also comes from military power.
Thomas Hammer, how do you see Europe's most important steps in building a bulwark against ISIS, despite these threats and despite its expansion? What's most important at home? What's most important abroad?
Well, to begin abroad, The most important thing is to weaken IS, obviously. And the challenge there is that IS straddles two countries. And in one of those countries, Syria, it is exceptionally difficult to get anything done against IS. And so in this spring, there will be a ground offensive in Iraq, and that offensive may well weaken IS considerably on the Iraqi side of the Syrian-Iraqi border. But IS will still have a safe haven on the Syrian side, and we don't have an effective sort of ground force there to rely upon to take away that that safe haven. We have a huge challenge there, and at home in Europe, the problem or the challenge now is that IS sympathy is skyrocketing in some Muslim communities. I see now levels of support for Islamic State that I never saw for Al-Qaeda in the 2000s. We've had street demonstrations in favor of IS. We have some radical ideologues coming on, you know, mainstream media openly declaring their support for IS.
And why? Why? How do you interpret that? Because they feel aggrieved by their economic or social situation in Europe? Because they want to see a caliphate established in the Middle East because they want Rome to fall to IS? Why?
I don't know for sure, but I think this has much to do with the fact that IS has momentum and that it offers a sort of a utopia. It offers a political alternative, a political project, which this sort of radical sort of side of the Muslim population in Europe has been looking for a while.
But it's so horrible, Thomas. You must have seen this news just today that 45 Iraqis burned to death yesterday by IS in Iraq. I mean, it's so brutal. Doesn't that give pause?
Absolutely, from our perspective. But the sympathizers don't see it that way at all. What they see is brutality that they view as necessary, as something that happens during war. And they see, they will argue that the brutality only targets enemies, only targets of Iraqi soldiers or Syrian soldiers or non-Muslims or Shiites. It doesn't unjustly target sort of the core population of the Islamic State. So they're not put off by that. They are attracted to what IS is offering, which is sort of a utopian state pure Islamic order. And I think that it's the availability of this new political project that is behind the rise in IS support in Europe. It's a previously it was just a sort of a fantasy, if you will, mm-hmm. in radical Islamist circles. But now it's there. You can go there. You can take your family and live the rest of your life there, some of these people think. And of course, there's a symbiosis going on between the foreign fighters on the ground in IS and the sympathizers at home. The people at home see their friends on Facebook, posting pictures from the ground in Syria. They like what they see, and then they work for IS at home. I think it's a very worrying development what we're seeing.
Gabe in Cambridge, last caller here. Hi, Gabe, you're on the air. Time is short.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, so look, I'm hearing a lot of great points from everyone. However, it doesn't seem to me that anyone is actually taking seriously the idea that ISIS could make it to Rome. And it seems far-fetched to me, but I think we really have to start taking them at their word. And if we don't, it could be a major mistake. kind of fall of a civilization mistake.
That's the warning from the Italian interior minister, something like that. Gabe, our time is so short. Bruce Hoffman, what about this threat? Is taking it seriously, falling into a trap of being baited? Or is Gabe right, you've got to take this seriously and do something about it?
Well, I think conquering Rome might be fanciful, but certainly carrying out terrorist attacks in Rome is within the reach of ISIS. I mean, there's been floods of Libyan immigrants attempting to reach Europe and especially using Italy as a gateway. So it's certainly not impossible and that there'll be terrorism. I think the conquering is a bit far-fetched. But this plays into ISIS's image of itself as being successful and invincible. I mean, look, ISIS's popularity is predicated on the fact that it's conquering territory, it's holding the territory, it's governing, and it has done what really no one else has been able to do since the end of World War I, which is redraw the map of the Middle East. And that's what they've done in the Levant. And that's part of its power. Until we make ISIS unsuccessful, until we push it back and start defeating it, it's going to continue to be able to draw recruits and support and to make these threats that will cause grave worry and consternation across Europe and elsewhere.
Thomas, last comment, question to you from one of our listeners. Says ISIS will crumble because it does not have moral authority over society like a virus. Sooner or later, they'll evaporate or be killed by local populations. Will ISIS burn out of its own heat, Thomas?
Well, I think so, but I think it will take longer than many people think. I don't think that it is sustainable because they're making too many enemies and because they are going to sort of succumb to economic forces. They will have economic problems within the Islamic State over time. Now they can keep afloat because they confiscate goods, they steal gold and grain and so on. But that's eventually going to run out, and they're going to find themselves isolated. And
could be a long road as long as they're in an expansion phase. Thomas Hegghammer with the Norwegian Defense Research Establishment in Oslo, thank you. And Bruce Hoffman, director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University, author of Anonymous Soldiers, out next week. Bruce Hoffman, thank you very much to you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.